What is up, everybody? Adrian M. Gibson here. What you're about to hear is the audio version of a live author panel recorded during TBRCon 2024, the latest edition of FanFiatic's all-virtual annual science fiction, fantasy, and horror convention, which streamed live between January 21st and January 28th, 2024. FanFiatic and TBRCon had the pleasure of hosting 25 amazing author panels, and we're so happy to be able to provide the audio for you for free here on the podcast feed. So, sit back, relax, and enjoy this fantastic TBRCon 2024 author panel.
Welcome, everyone, to TBRCon 2024 Day 2, first panel of the day, How to Write Great Endings. I am your host, David Walters from FanFiatic, the kind of creator of TBRCon from 4 years ago. It's kind of weird. I feel a little nervous. I haven't been on camera in a while, so this is kind of an odd place to be. But I just want to thank you all for coming in. Thank my panelists for being here. So I want to start out having everybody introduce themselves. So Lucy, we'll start with you.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for being here. I'm Lucy Holland. I'm a historical fantasy author. I wrote Sister Song in 2021. And this book, Song of the Huntress, is due out in a couple of months' time. It's another historical fantasy, and it's a myth retelling of The Wild Hunt. I'm also one third of the intersectional feminist podcast, Breaking the Glass Slipper.
Sue?
Hi, I'm Sue Burke, and I'm greeting you from cold and snowy Chicago. You can look out my window and see Lakeshore Drive. I live in a skyscraper, so it's a nice view. I've been writing professionally actually for 50 years. I started out as a journalist, and I've been writing science fiction from the 1990s. My most recent novel is Dual Memory. I've also written Immunity Index and the Semiosis Trilogy, which is Semiosis, Interference, and Usurpation, which comes out this fall. And I've also written short stories and other stuff.
Fantastic. Sebastian?
Hi, I'm Sebastian DeCastel. I wrote the Greatcoat series, which is swashbuckling fantasy, and the Spellslinger series, which is young adult sort of magical fantasy. My most recent book is Crucible of Chaos, which is the first new book in the Greatcoats world in a while. And Play of Shadows, the delayed most number of times other than I think Winds of Winter book ever is coming out in at the end of March in the UK, beginning of April in North America. And this time, I for sure, if you look at my shelf behind me there on the top left corner, you can actually see it. So it actually exists this time. But yeah.
Brian?
Hi, everyone. I'm Brian Wilson. My personal life, I'm a new home construction contractor, but I'm also an author. So because of that, I sometimes like to market myself as a home builder by day, world builder by night. My first novel, The Forsaken Planet, was a science fantasy novel. It's the first of a series called Power of the Stars. I think the best way to describe it is it's a sci-fi space opera, starts off in our contemporary world, follows a couple average Joe 20-year-olds, and it whisks them away to a futuristic fantasy world. Fantasy is very much at the core of the story. And it's got this whole overarching theme of a power struggle with this ancient alien mythology lore behind it.
Sweet. Well, thanks. Thanks to all of you for being here. So I know we're here to talk about endings. There are several authors I could probably mention on several hands that probably need to be here for this panel, but you know, we'll get to that later. But I want to start out, endings are one thing, but how do you hook a reader at the beginning to actually get them to the ending of the novel? Because I, as a reader, as a reviewer, you know, hooks are pretty much what's going to get you to finish a novel. So, Sebastian, I want to start with you. How do you hook a reader at the beginning to actually even get them to the end?
I think, for me, a lot of the time it'll be just an intriguing premise. right? A question about something that sort of sparks it for you. I'm reading a book right now called The Cartographers. I think it's by Peng Shepherd. Hopefully I'm not getting her name wrong. Where it begins with the death of her father, who's an expert in cartography, and this sort of mysterious map that shouldn't be worth anything, but it seems like people are killing over it because it has a paper town. Paper towns are a phenomenon of cartography because it was so hard to protect. If you're in the business of making maps, then your data, like your resource, is the survey information, is like knowing where everything is. But as soon as you publish it, anyone can steal it, and it's almost impossible to prove they stole it. So there's a phenomenon in cartography where they call paper towns, where they'll put a fake town on a map that doesn't exist, so that if somebody else puts it on their map, you know they stole your map and you can sue them. And so, beginning with that premise of why this map, something like that, like it, if you think about how that intersects, you've got the question, like, why was this person murdered? And like, why would a map be involved, the seemingly irrelevant gas station map? But also the idea that there's like a subject matter that we're going to explore. We're going to go in somewhere. Dan Brown, I think, does this quite well. I'm not a giant fan of the stories themselves, but like of going, hey, there's this whole world of stuff you can look at. Like with the Greatcoats, for me, it was all about the sort of the swashbuckling and the notion of these swashbuckling judges, traveling judges, which was a real thing in 12th century England, the justice's itinerant. And so when you kind of open up with, here's an intriguing premise and here's this subject area that you're going to get to kind of explore, I think that tends to be a good way to hook readers.
Anybody else want to take that on?
Yeah, I've also heard it put that you have a question at the beginning. And in fact, if it's a novel, you can have several questions. Ursula Le Guin in Dispossessed, she opens with a description of there's a wall and it separates two people. And it's very important that these people are separated. And so you're a couple paragraphs in and you go, well, what's the deal here? Why is this so important? And of course, then she goes on to answer it.
I just wanted to jump in with a favorite quote from a brilliant author, Rosemary Sutcliffe, who says in The Shining Company, the end of a story is part of it from the beginning. And that really made me think, because she's right, it is. I think a good ending, I know we'll get onto this later, as in, differing from a bad ending, a good ending is the logical consequence, of the events of a story, a logical consequence or a result of your character's journey, their arc, their conflicts. And I think all of those things are seeded in the very beginning, the opening pages of the book. I was kind of thinking about this. I was like, oh, this is such a good quote. How can I apply this to famous books that I know quite well? And I was thinking about Frodo, and how he the journey to destroy the ring breaks him. Like, you could argue that he's the broken hero. He can't ever come back from that journey. And I, you could see that possibly that, Tolkien was foreshadowing that very much from the beginning, where, he was setting Frodo up to be a very different character from Bilbo. He's not like Bilbo. He didn't really want to go on his adventure. The call to adventure kind of yanked him out the door, and he never had that sort of joy in his heart to go forth and complete a heroic quest. And you do wonder, reading that and seeing that kind of reluctance, that actually the end of his storyline was always there. You always knew he was going to be broken by the journey, and that he wouldn't ever be able to recover. So I think that there is something in that. And now that I'm writing a new book, I've been trying to keep that in mind for my next sort of character arc. How am I going to, if I don't quite know the end, I have an idea about the end. But I think it's really interesting that you can kind of almost know what it's going to be right from the very first page.
Yeah, I mean, to go with what Lucy's saying, I think for myself, my favorite endings have a lot to do with you're almost told or given a hint of the direction of where the ending's going to be at the beginning, but the meat of the story is so creatively done that it kind of, even though you've been basically told what's going to happen, you almost forget about it, or it's just done in a creative way that makes you still shocked and awed. at the end of it. And, you know, to go with what Sebastian said, I think it's all about, I agree, it's all about the premise. One of my favorite series is Red Rising. And in the beginning of that series, you really only know you follow the main character. There's kind of there's two different classes. Well, there's multiple different classes of people, but you have the main character at the bottom class and kind of fighting against the upper class. And that's just, to me, that was a very intriguing premise to kind of, you're given the whole backstory, but you're given this backstory of these people struggling, and that led to the meat of the story of the conflict of kind of facing the upper class. So,
yeah, I would, and even with Red Rising, going to your example, in my opinion, is one of the weaker books in that entire, well, you know, several books now. It's not just an original trilogy anymore, but you know, it's enough to, okay, what is Darrow's, you know, what is his desire out of all this? And then you kind of start, I mean, just in the first, you know, 10 or 15 pages, you're like, okay, why is this happening to him? Why is it not happening to anybody else, kind of thing?
Yeah, it's kind of a simple premise, but it's one that easily emotionally pulls you into it.
Yeah, and it builds and builds and builds and builds. So endings. I'm curious, from the perspectives of authors that write, you know, single novels, you know, standalones versus series. How do you go into write? Do you go into writing a, you know, the ending of a standalone differently than you do for maybe like a sequel, you know, in like a trilogy, or you know, maybe the first book in the series? Like, do you always, like, I guess what is the recipe for that ending, you know, for a standalone versus one for a series? And Brian, I'll start with you, because I know you're in the midst of your series.
Well, I don't personally have experience publishing a standalone piece, but I would imagine on that end of things, it's probably a little more difficult. You only have the one volume to tell your full story to its proper conclusion, to an emotional and suspenseful conclusion. Whereas with a series, you have a little more wiggle room to, yes, you have to find the balance of making a good ending for that particular installment. But also, you know, keeping the intrigue to keep people wanting to read further and further, but that also allows you more wiggle room to kind of leave some mystery to the overall overarching theme, or maybe the main conflict that's going on, to leave some things open-ended and, you know, the unfinished.
Yeah, because I feel like, you know, going into sequels, you have to have enough of that hook that you have at the beginning of the novel to keep, you know, readers coming back for more. But at the same time, you can't wrap up too much, because then you don't have a lot of meat left on the bone. Or maybe you do, and you just are like, we're going to go to a different world for book two, and then we're going to come back to this one for book three. But yeah. Sebastian, I'll ask you, because so I know you've written several series now, I know you've have experience in that. So what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I never really write with a kind of a conscious sense of I'm going to write a series or I'm going to write a novel or like a standalone. Because I think, you know, the story has to kind of go where the story goes. And so Malevolent 7, for example, which is one of my more recent books, was ostensibly meant to be a standalone. But then by the end, you're like, oh, yeah, I guess there's a series here. So, you know, that's kind of how it works. If you want to write, the easiest way, if you want to write a standalone, here's a concrete, because sometimes we can get very ephemeral or ethereal, rather, with these kind of discussions. Here's a super good concrete way if you want to make sure your book is a standalone. Kill your main character at the end. Works every time. Totally feels like a standalone. So a lot of people don't know this, but Traitor's Blade, which is my first book, it's the first of the Greatcoats books, which pretty much launched my career. The original ending of that book is Falchio dies at the end. And that I always knew that if it was published that I wouldn't be allowed to do that, and that I wouldn't want to do that, because there was more to explore with that character. But that for me was a way of writing the book and just knowing I was going to leave it all out on the field, like just really put every single good, say everything I could with that character in that book. And it kind of worked. And then, you know, the trick was figuring out for how to make him not die at the end. once I had a publishing deal, because it was a 4-book deal. So that quickly meant I had to solve that problem. But yeah, that's the great David Gerald, is, you know, one of those sort of grandmasters of science fiction. I met him a few years ago when I think I was at Worldcon, and we had signing tables next to each other. And at the time I was trying to write the end of the Greatcoats books. And I said, like, hey, you know, how do you write the end of a series? And he said, you know, your series is over when your characters have said all they need to say. And so when I'm looking at whether it's a standalone or a series, one of the things I just ask myself is, have the characters said everything that they needed to say? You know, because when you're at the point where there's nothing new you can say with those characters, then it doesn't matter whether you were intending to write a 7-book series, but you've actually only hit book 2. You know, you can't just keep to make them suddenly have to say new things. You're going to have to change the characters around so much that you almost might as well write new characters. So that's really the question for me. Like, you know, writing in a sense, writing a great ending is more about discovering when you're actually done, and you discover when you're done, when your characters say things, are like, oh, they're telling me, you know, in a way, they're telling me that this is done. That's the end.
Lucy?
Well, I know, I just want to say that I completely agree with Sebastian. It's a really interesting and true thing that should kind of happen, really. Character for me has always been the driving force behind, you know, all of my books. And actually, as someone who has written an epic fantasy trilogy and who is now moved to writing standalones, I'm kind of on both sides of the experience here. I think the hardest ending I've ever had to write was for book 2 of my trilogy, because book 2 is a horrible, horrible thing. It's a bridging book. It's got to be a bridge between book 1 and book 3. Book 1 is fine. You know, I feel like I wrapped up that book. You could probably just read it on its own and be like, okay, that was a fun book. I don't really need to go any further. And I wanted it to be like that. But book 2, I couldn't do that, because by that point, you know, I'd said, right, I'm expanding the story out. I'm going into a new world. I'm bringing new characters, but I'm also continuing the stories of the original characters. And that book, because it was by nature the second book, I really couldn't do quite the same thing again. I couldn't tie everything up. It was not possible, because I knew that the book was going to be 3 books. So I really struggled with that. And it's made me, now that I've moved into the standalone field, I'm very reluctant to venture back the other way again, because for many, many reasons, chiefly that it's almost impossible to market a series these days, unless you're super famous. But also because endings are hard. You know, they're not, I don't feel like I nail mine first time. I feel like they change, you know, through draft to draft. I need to kind of figure out what it is I really want to say and how I really want to end it. But I feel like I kind of know before I start writing if a book is going to be, you know, it's definitely going to be a standalone. And at the moment, the idea is Sister Song's a standalone, Song of the Huntress is a standalone, the one I'm writing now is a standalone. The one thing that kind of unites them is that I carry at least one or two characters, sometimes just minor characters, forward into the next book. So there is a sort of thematic link between all of them. And maybe that weaves into kind of how I see endings on, or how I don't see them as how I kind of want to continue the story, but in a sort of, you know, not in a kind of self-contained way, if that makes sense.
So you kind of end it, but you also weave them in. You leave it open-ended.
I mean, like, I'll probably say about this a little bit more, but, you know, for me, like, the best endings are bittersweet. I don't like happy, happy endings. I also don't like nihilistic endings. I feel like bittersweet endings contain the most promise, and they also are the most realistic. And that is, it's something that, you know, if anyone's familiar with my historical fantasy, they will recognize that. There's also a lot of, when I had to come up with words, I think it was like 3 words to describe Sister Song, I think I came up with tragedy, triumph, and sisterhood. But the tragedy and the triumph are of equal equal weight in my books. And that's reflected in the ending, you know. I don't want to make anyone depressed, but I also have a bit of a kind of hatred of fluffy endings, where everyone is all's well that ends well.
What about you, Sue?
Well, I tend to approach things more from plot than from character. So, as I've said before, there'll be a question, and the story is over when the question is answered. For example, in Semiosis, my novel, we have some human colonists on another planet, and the question was always, are they going to survive? Because it's a very dangerous planet. And at the end, yeah, they're going to survive, and these are the conditions in which they're going to survive. And then I fit everything into that big question. So that's how I look at it. But if you're going to do a series, you might have some questions that remain open at the end. They're going to survive, but what about this? In the next book, yeah, everyone's going back to Earth, but they're taking the aliens with them. So now what happens on Earth with the aliens? So everybody's safe, except in the next book, they're probably not going to be. So I approach it from a plot and then find characters who can live in that plot and have to deal with the problems I threw at them.
Yeah. I gotcha. I want to bring in a question from the chat. So Christopher wants to know, does anyone have their endings planned or written first and then decide where to begin the story? Lucy, I'll start with you.
Absolutely not. Ever. I have the vaguest idea of my endings before I start writing. My first draft is, and I know many people say the same thing, but this is me saying it too. It is me telling myself the story. I'm a pantser, or, you know, a gardener, as George R. R. Martin puts it more elegantly. I love to discover. I'm a discovery writer. I like to be with my characters. I like to get to know them. And in that sense, I just simply cannot kind of grasp the ending of their stories before I've spent a lot of time with them. So it's almost impossible for me to do that. I really do need to, be traveling with them, be researching the world as I go along. And the ending grows out of that journey organically.
How about you, Brian?
I think I'm a little bit of the opposite of Lucy. I'm very much a plotter, I think they're called. I plan everything. I have a very in-depth outline before going in, but it's not everything. I shouldn't say everything, but I very much have my ending and my beginning. I know the starting point. I know the ending point, and I kind of find the journey a little bit through the meat in the middle of it, how to get there. Because I know a theme and what I want to tell at the end. And so for me, it's about kind of just the journey, explaining how this came about.
Mm-hmm. What about you, Sue?
I try not to write at all unless I know how it's going to end, because you can't. I don't think you can have a really strong ending if you don't know where you're going. So people pants. My problem with it is not that it doesn't work. It's just that it's probably the longest and most painful way to write, because I've tried that. And you just wind up rewriting and rewriting and rewriting. But if you think it through and you do the exploration and you work with the characters, and you can spend a lot of time plotting, but by the time you get to start to write, it can go much more efficiently and you can build things in and put in your foreshadowing, because you know where your journey is going to end. So I'm really in favor of doing that just for efficiency. Yeah, you can pants, but it's just a hard, hard way to write.
Well, the problem is, if for me, plot comes from character. And until I know my characters, there's no plot.
Well, you got to do both at the same time when you plan. This is not one or the other. You need to do both. I mean, I can't start writing until I know who my characters are, too.
Sebastian?
Well,
Play of Shadows will be my 16th novel. Wow. And at no point have I discovered a discernible writing process that I apply. There's no writing technique you could name that doesn't at some point go into the way I write a book. It's just a completely random mess. For me, that's the thing. For me, every book is so different that the process of writing it, even if a reader would say, yeah, oh, this is a DeCastro book, I know that guy's vibe. You know, a lot of swashbuckling, some banter, haha, long speech stolen from Shakespeare. But for me, it's always so radically different that I've stopped trying to find it. I have my favorite writing process, which works sometimes, so for me, it's less about discovery and it's less about knowing. It's more about I have to find like an engine. I have to find a source of emotional juice that's going to drive me through the book. So Malevolent 7, which was, I swear to God, Malevolent 7 was a book that I was not intending to publish at all. I like when I wrote that book, I was like, nobody's going to publish this book. Like it's way too, you know, just offensive on every possible level. Which of course meant that it was like the easiest sale of a book I've ever had. It's bizarre. But I was in a particular mood. I was feeling this kind of vibe of, you know, I'd just come off writing the 6 Spellslinger books, which were 2 books a year across 3 years, a young adult. And I was watching as every single, I was watching as the language is getting more and more policed, not to blame of any copy editors or editors. I happen to be lucky to have fabulous editors on those books, but because the zeitgeist, like the culture was changing, where now every, you know, like every word was like, well, that could be seen as a bad word. Yeah, but it's not in this context. Well, it doesn't matter. And so I was feeling that hyper constraint, and because I'm an old white man, you know, like I always have that feeling like everybody's trying to stop my freedom of speech. Right. And so I was like, fuck it. I'm going to spend a month. I'm just going to write whatever the hell I want. I'm gonna write all the things people, you know, and you're not supposed to do, you know. I'm gonna and also I hate all the quote rules of fantasy that people impose, like from now on everybody's magic system should be like Brandon Sanderson, like it has to have that sort of verisimilitude sort of vibe, and like he's great, but it's not my vibe. So I was just like, I'm gonna live this book. And so I wrote that book in 30 days. Actually, it was February, so I wrote it in 28 days. And basically every week I tend to write in 4 acts. Every week was 1 act. Monday was like, okay, it's the beginning of something. And by the time I'm hitting Sunday, I better have found the end of it. And I found, like, for me, like living that process, it was like living the book, right? And that's sort of one of my favorite ways to write. But I write like, but for example, I'm working on a book now called Our Lady of Blades. I could show you like hundreds of documents of outlines and house, you know, hierarchies and all of this kind of stuff and documents about the legal system that they're applying in that world. And none of it makes a difference. It's just a process of banging my head against the wall until occasionally the pain is so intense that I have to stop by making myself type some words. So it's, yeah, I'm a complete mess.
Well, I think like reading, I think probably writing is a little subjective, you know, for a particular person. I mean, I agree with Sue completely. I can't imagine writing a story without knowing where it's going, without knowing what my ending is. But I'm not like Sebastian. I haven't done 16 books yet. So who am I to say that, you know, down the road, that might not be my path to writing a certain topic that I decide to do. So
could I just to interject one thing, because of course, like, that's the beauty of it. Like, this is the benefit of something like this for other writers and readers who are watching, right? It's just to see that actually it's okay. Like, whatever, you'll find what works for you. And for some folks on the panel, like, they found what works, and that's great. And then for some people like me, I've never found what totally works, but that doesn't stop you from writing novels. You just kind of plow ahead. But the one thing I'd say, maybe Brian, if we're ever in the same city, we can do this together, because I know a lot of writers who you know will be like, I need to know where it's going to go. I do this thing now. I first did it with Christian Cameron, but I've done it like with I don't know, half a dozen other writers, where we basically take an hour and we write a short story together, starting from nothing, and we have to get to the end of a short story, and it's alternating 5-minute sprints. And every single time I've done this, you get the sense of, we have no idea where we're going. We have no, there's no way this is going to work. By about the eighth or ninth sprint, you're like, there's no way an ending's going to work. And it always appears. And so I tend to think it's a really good exercise, not because it should change anyone's writing process, but because it is kind of wonderful to discover that actually the story has its own kind of weird energy. Like if you launch it, it will find a place.
Yeah, I think that, I will say that the novel I'm turning in now, which is Usurpation, I knew how it had to end. And I was literally writing the last chapter going, how is this going to work? How am I going to make all of these things happen? And so I was trying to figure out my way through that chapter. And then I realized, oh, yeah, they already solved that problem in the last chapter. But now I understand what they did. So there's some discovery in here, too. I don't want to make it sound like I plan everything. But I do think it helps. There's a story Paul Anderson wrote called Utopia, and it's in Dangerous Visions. The very last word of that story changes everything that happened in it. And I don't know how he did that, but I can't imagine, as I don't want to do spoilers here, because if you can read this story, you should. But I can't imagine that he started not knowing that that was going to be the end. And he came up with a very good story. Now, maybe he writes in all sorts of different ways, like Sebastian, but that one had to be done that way.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, not that it's any comparison to Paul Henderson, but I wrote a book, Way of the Argosy, which is a young adult fantasy novel, where I swear to God, until I was writing the epilogue, it was as I was writing the epilogue that not only did I find the last line that makes everything else make sense, but where I realized who the story was being told to the entire time. And I had no idea until that exact moment that, oh my God, she's been telling this story to this person this entire time. And it altered the complexion of the rest of the story. I agree with you 100%. See, like sometimes you can get there by planning. And if you wanted the most reliable way to, you know, just like in real life, right? If you want to start a business, if you want to build a house, Brian can probably speak to this better, but the most reliable way to get there is going to be through planning. If what you want to aim for is that 5% of the time where it's the ingenuity of the moment that suddenly gives you this thing, but with sometimes a 95% risk that it'll fail, then that other route is sometimes good for that.
Yeah, when Sue was mentioning Paul Anderson, I thought of Ian Reed's "I'm Thinking of Ending Things." It's one that I've never read another book where you can read it all the way through, you know, straight forward, and then also read it backward as a completely different story. And I can't imagine how that idea populated and how it was executed the way it was. Now, it's also a book that is very hot and cold with certain readers. There's a lot of people that don't like it, a lot of people that love it. I'm on the love it side of it. Maybe not so much. The book was great, but. It makes me wonder, like, you know, did he know the ending, you know, when he was writing it, or, you know, as he was writing it, you go, it'd be really cool if I did this and flip-flopped it, you know, as soon as you get to the end. So I'm actually, I'm going to bring up a question that Brian sent me a couple of days ago. I want to preface it by this, because I think at least from my perspective, you know, I hate to bring up PTSD on his with COVID, but during that time, I feel like Grimdark, like is at least in fantasy, was like very, very popular. A lot of people loved to read it. I don't know if it was just everybody's mood during that time or what, but like, you know, dark endings and dark plots and nihilistic characters and very gray moral, you know, morals and so forth was pretty popular. But Brian asks, he goes, the current literary world's view on the straight, you know, happy endings to stories, do you think that's making a comeback, or do people still desire a more realistic take? And Sue, I want to start with you.
Every time I hear someone say that there's a trend, 6 months later, that trend peters out. So no one cares. It can be happy, it can be sad. Well, okay, if it's a romance, it really should end happily ever after, because that's what romances do. And if it's a mystery, you really need to solve the mystery. And, you know, if it's a funny story, it should end with a punchline. But once you move out of those kinds of tropes and plots, and you can do anything you want. And anyway, by the time it's going to get to the market, unless you're, even if you're self-publishing, everyone's going to have a different opinion anyway.
Yeah, that whole like 6 months trend is like, as soon as your book's out, everybody's going to be wanting, you know, a different ending.
I spent my time in the COVID lockdown reading the funniest books I could get my hands on.
Right. Because
I was just not in a good mood.
Yeah. Yeah. Lucy, your thoughts?
Well, like Sue, yeah, I think it's dangerous to jump on bandwagons and depend on trends as being here to stay. I will say this one thing about romanticy, which is one of my hated words. I have noticed that more than one of the really big publishing houses has actually opened romanticy imprints now in the wake of the current romanticy trend, which is somewhat alarming, but also somewhat reassuring, because I feel like those books will have somewhere to go, and that it might help that sort of idea that, you know, people might pick my book up. And I mean, the thing is that with my previous book, Sister Song, I had a lot of, all three characters were, you know, 20 or under. And I had a lot of people believing it was young adult. You know, while there's nothing wrong with young adult, I have said quite clearly that I don't write it. And that was not the intended audience. So it's kind of a nice thing in a way that there is an imprint, there is a label, there is a place for romanticy now, because it's then not bleeding over quite so much in, you know, across the entire field of fantasy, which I see happening, you know, has been happening quite a lot, that lots of readers are approaching certain books by certain authors with a certain set of expectations. I think I might come a cropper with this with my newest book, because my characters are all in their mid-30s. I got tired of seeing books about young protagonists. I was like, I need to write a story about people like me, you know, who have to, you know, we're mid-30s, we don't cope with our problems in the same way. We have a totally different set of problems. But because I am, you know, a young female writer, and because I have worked with young characters before, I do wonder how many people are going to go into the new book sort of with this set of expectations, and finding, you know, actually the main relationship in the book is about a marriage and how it's breaking down, and how it might not. So it's a much more, it's not first love, let's just say that. So yes, I'm not sure where I was going with that, but I also to try and drag it back into like kind of tropesville, you know, maybe it's a good thing that we can say, yes, romanticism is here to stay, and, you know, here is a place for it.
Sebastian?
Yeah. There's a bizarre tyranny of a certain kind of fandom over literary genres where not even, and I don't blame the people who love a certain kind of book for it, but where they start talking about this, like they are the ones that really define the genres, right? In the sense that they see some elements of a book. Like if you take any book that's being called romanticy, I haven't read Fourth Wing, but I think it's fair to say that it's described as romanticy. So I'm not going to make, statements about the book, other than I'm almost positive if you read that book, you'd find there's actually lots of different kinds of things going on. But the parts that people have talked about online have tended to be around the sort of notion of romanticism. So now we're going to kind of put that in a certain box. And then all of a sudden, publishers, because they're, you know, the bravest of businesses, go, oh my God, let's just create this imprint because everybody on Twitter is talking about this thing. With the same rapidity with which they go, oh my God, let's cancel this new book that we paid a six figures for because everyone on Twitter is saying it's problematic. Like they just sort of nosedive wherever this conversation is happening, always forgetting that Twitter is like the least representative thing you could find in the universe. Like it's like 85% bots, and the rest of it is the people who have enough time and inclination to get into arguments about stuff. And so the problem for authors, especially people who are watching, especially people who are going, hey, I want to break into this business, I want to be a novelist, is that you can start to suddenly feel like, oh my God, like I've got to go this way, or I've got to adapt to this thing. But the problem is, if you try to go, because Fourth Wing is popular, I'm going to write romantasy. Again, I don't know the author at all, but I'll bet that what they were doing was actually just trying to write a really great story that has lots of things in it, including romance and fantasy. And so if you let yourself be boxed in, you will only conform to a set of tropes that will never be complete enough to allow you to do what is the actual function of writing a novel, which is taking all of your inner experiences and thoughts and feelings and your demons and transforming them into a story, because it's so complex and so intricate. If you tried to explain your experiences and your feelings and your demons to someone, they would never understand. But if you turn it into a story, all of a sudden they can share some of those feelings. That's the function of what we do. And so that's why I think it's so important to sort of go, you know, as Lucy said, it's great that now there's a place where certain books can go and not just be rejected out of hand. But as a writer, and if I sit down and try to write something that's popular, I just suck at it so badly. It's like when people say to me, it's like when people write things like, you know, oh, this writer, you know, writes this, you know, they should write more about this type of demographic or this type of character. And I'm like, I'm only good enough to write well if I'm doing exactly the stuff that I can do. If I try to like write somebody else's book, I would be horrible at it. So, but the last thing I was going to say is I want to just formally reject the premise of the question that grimdark is realistic.
What about you, Brian?
Yeah, I mean, to go along with what Sue was sort of saying, it obviously depends on the genre. If you're writing a mystery, a thriller, or something kind of in the contemporary world, I think you want it to be a little more realistic. Things usually aren't rainbows and butterflies, so you can't do that. And if you're writing, you know, you're writing grimdark, especially something like that, it's going to be skewing towards the tragic side, if, you know, bittersweet tragic side, bittersweet at the best. But I think I more ask that question as I read mostly fantasy and sci-fi. And so maybe it's just a little bubble I'm in, but I asked it more as I feel like I see a trend towards the grimdark, more towards the bittersweet tragic. And I guess I'm someone I more like the happy ending, even if it's not realistic. You know, I got two little toddlers at home. I want to cry every time I go to the grocery store. We all have, you know, the stress in our life. And so I read to get away from that, to try and forget that. I don't want my stories to kind of remind me of that or bring me of that. So that was the point of that question. Just wondering, because I feel like there's more of that out in the world today, where people want more of that hopeful outlook, as in comparison to, as you said, David, COVID. So,
right.
That's why I asked that question.
Yeah. I'd like to build on something that Lucy said. One of the books I'd really like to suggest as having a really great ending. It's called Meet Me in Another Life by Catriona Silvey. And it's a science fiction novel, although you might not realize that at first. But when I read that book, I was just weeping at the end. It was such a sad but logical ending. And but anyway, it is also a love story. And I was reading on Goodreads. It overall has a very high rating, but who gave it 1 star? And these were people who came to it, and maybe they just heard, well, it's a love story, and it is, but it does not end happily ever after. It is not a romance. It is a science fiction story, and science fiction can end any way we want to do it. It doesn't have to be one way or another. There's no law, no rules in this. And so the people who didn't like it, who weren't very many, but they came in with expectations that were not appropriate to the kind of book that it was. And I think that happens, as you get readers who think you should write this, you should write that, you should do that character. Well, no, And that wasn't what she was trying to do. And she did it very, very well. But it's not a romance. It's a science fiction novel. So, again, Meet Me in Another Life by Catriona Sylvie. I cannot recommend it too much.
So, endings. We'll get to, you know, favorite endings, your least favorite endings in movies, books, film, TV, etc. But I want to know, and Lucy touched on this a little bit, you know, kind of leaving an ending a little bit open-ended, you know, by using characters and, you know, next novels and so forth. But, you know, when you're setting to finish your series or finish your standalone, do you want your ending to be like complete? Do you want it to like, okay, this is where it's going to end. This is the finale. Or do you want to leave it like ambiguous where like, you know, the reader finishes and they go, well, I guess this could have happened or this happened. Like, do you leave it a little bit open-ended to actually, you know, have those questions? Do you feel that readers want that? I mean, I'm kind of, it depends on the book. I guess it depends on when I get to the end and I go, okay, you know, some thought-provoking, you know, ending is nice. But I also like to know, okay, these characters are all done here and we can move on to something else. And Brian, I want to start with you.
I personally am not huge. I mean, it can be done in a, you know, a positive way that makes a good ending. I'm not huge on ambiguous endings. You know, a story is so, the ending is so important because it's the last impact someone's going to have, last influence someone's going to have on a story. So for me personally, I consider myself a creative. If you're going to leave it completely open-ended for me to decide the ending, my problem is I could think of 20 endings. I don't want to do that. I like your story, your world. I want you to tell me the ending. I think a perfect example of this was I watched the Netflix. Netflix movie, Leave the World Behind. And I was just fully pulled into that movie. We watched it. I thought we were only going to watch half of it before we went to sleep. And we were so into it. We absolutely loved it. And, that was probably 90% of the way in, but there was also all this mystery, all this, it just kept bringing very interesting questions to the forefront, but then it never really sort of answered them at the end, but it left it kind of up to your interpretation. And for me, that just, the movie went from, I thought I was definitely going to be blasting it in my newsletter, telling everyone I knew to go watch it. And it just kind of made it an okay ending. It lowered the overall product for me. So I am definitely someone that I try to, I'm not going to write anything into my stories unless I have an explanation for it, at least at some point before the end of the story. Sure, you can leave it up to interpretation of if you have characters. Obviously, you don't have to tell exactly what the rest of their life is till they're 100 years old, but I'm of the type I want to at least give a certain idea at the end of, say, if there's a love story, you know what transpired for the two people by the end of it.
Lucy?
Well, I want my characters to live beyond the page. I've always wanted that. Even my fantasy trilogy, you know, even though the book is finished, I feel like, you know, they're still there. They're still doing things. They haven't finished their lives. It's just that we're not traveling with them any longer. It's almost like, you know, when you shut your eyes and you've got a film on, the film is still going on. And it's kind of like that when a reader walks away from the book. I don't, you know, they kind of hopefully take the characters with them. And I think maybe that is slightly reflected in the way I end my stories. I try to wrap up the questions that I've posed, the conflicts that the characters have encountered, you know, in themselves and with each other. But very often, especially when you work with young characters, you know, they won't have completely resolved everything. They're still young people with a long journey ahead of them. They still have many, many things to do in their lives. And I kind of like the sense of leaving a reader with that. So, you know, and it's kind of, that's a nice thing as well, because if you forced a bittersweet ending on someone, you also kind of feel like, you know, there is some hope there for, I mean, the ending of, I won't say anything about Song of the Huntress because it's not out yet, but that is definitely very bittersweet. And there's a couple of, the two main characters definitely don't resolve their problems. There's definitely some problems that they need to work through. But the story, I feel the story is finished because I have brought them back together. I've brought them to a place in which they can work together to resolve the issues that they have outstanding. And that gives me a sense that they live beyond the page, that they're still kind of out there solving those problems. You know, not every problem has to be actively solved by the author. And I think, yeah, that's pretty much how I approach most of my endings. I just like, you know, it's not to say it's an open ending, but it's to say that there is, you know, I have addressed the major things that need to be addressing without closing everything down.
Sebastian?
I guess it's worth asking the question, you know, what is the function of an ending of a novel or a series? In other words, you know, what is its purpose? Because it seems like one of those things that's sort of, you know, obvious. Well, you know, it's to wrap up the book, right? But okay, but why? It's to wrap up the book in a way that does something for the reader, right? Like, we write novels for the readers. And so, yeah, on one level, the ending, you know, the function of the ending, the purpose of the ending can be to leave the reader with a particular feeling that they're going to hang on to for a while. So like a really satisfying ending, let's say of a romance novel, a really wonderfully satisfying ending of a romance novel, you sort of would carry that feeling with you for the rest of the day, maybe the rest of the week. And that's sort of the purpose of that. But there's other endings, and I think probably Sue can speak to this better than I, because I think it, and Brian, because I think it happens more in sci-fi than it does in fantasy, is sometimes to provoke a set of thoughts, to provoke a set of questions that will continue, that you don't necessarily want the ending to be, and now we're all done. Like in an adventure, it's nice when it's like, and now here's the feeling you're going to go with. But sometimes with sci-fi, it's, you know, God, I think I read Peter Watt's Blindsight, and you finish reading that book and you just spend the rest of the year going, oh my God, are humans even conscious at all? It's, you know, because it's thought provoking. For me, I tend to look at two things, and you know, again, to try to be practical for people who are watching, who are, you know, trying to write from in their own career, and wrestling with endings. I tend to think, one, you have to remember, what have you promised that you were going to deliver, right? So books are all about questions. You pose questions and then you answer the questions, or you don't answer the questions, you move it forward, you do whatever you're going to do. But, you know, are these people going to survive on this planet, right? Is a question. And how you pose that question early in the book determines whether you have to answer it or not. Because if you make it clear, like, yeah, this book, this series is going to answer this question, and then you don't, then I think it leaves people with a sense of being unsatisfied, like somehow they're missing a chapter and they've been robbed. On the flip side, if you answer everything with like absolute totality and finality, so when we get into like least favorite endings, I think The Last Battle by C.S. Lewis for me is one of those, but only because of how he treats Susan. It's just like, no, that's it. Like, it's answered. We're done. The universe is, you know, has now collapsed down on itself, as if he just unleashed a giant black hole in the middle of Narnia. And that's not always so great either. The technique that I think I prefer is where you just are very specific in telling the reader, like your characters are basically telling the reader that some things aren't going to be answered and some things are. Like the Great Coats, I tend to think the quartet has a pretty strong ending. Like, you kind of know Falchio's journey is kind of done on this arc, and all the sort of questions are answered. But it also, in the epilogue, starts to ask a whole bunch of other questions. Like, holy shit, Kest has joined, is forming an order of knights, like the Greycoats hate knights. Like, what's that going to be like? And Brasti is joining the Rangieri. Like, what's that going to be like? And because for me, one of the functions, and I'm sorry, I'll wrap up quick. One of the functions of an ending is to turn the story over to the readers, is to go, my part in telling this story is done, and now here's space for you to kind of hold the story in, not to fight online about what's canon and what's Ted canon and what's not, but take the story and let your own imagination kind of wander for a while. And so I really like to try to go, I ask myself at the end of a series, like, have I given the reader space to now take over the story?
Sue, thoughts?
Yeah, I think that that's a very good way to describe it. I try to think, although this dovetails with it, is that the reader knows what the characters are going to do next, but in a good way. So for my most recent novel, which is Dual Memory, there's an island and there's a big problem, and the characters solve the problem on the island. But now they're leaving the island. What happens next? Well, you have some clues, and we know, and they're going to do this, and they're going to join that, and so the reader can decide that for themselves. But that episode in the life is done, and now we know what's going to happen next. In Immunity Index, there were these sisters who didn't know each other existed, and at the end of the story, they're going to finally meet face to face for the first time, and it's a very sweet ending. But then what happens? I like to think that they lead sweet lives forever. I don't know. Readers might have a different opinion, but they can imagine what the next scene is going to be and maybe the next few scenes after that. And if they want to make up a whole nother lives for these characters, and I know a couple fans did, they can do that and that's fine. And I gave them what they need to do that.
Anybody else have any other thoughts before we go to our nice ending of favorite and least favorite endings of, of media? All good? Okay. So, Lucy, we'll just start with you. So, you've got plenty of time. So, I want to know, what is your favorite movie or book or TV series ending, and what's your least favorite?
Well,
and why?
Given the title of this panel, I should have come prepared for this question. I have not come prepared for this question. The one thing that that jumped immediately to mind about my least favorite ending, do you know the film What Dreams May Come? It's an old Robin Williams film. I think it's based on a novel. I have not read the novel, so this is not a comment on the novel. It is a comment on the film. I really liked that film. I thought it was really well. I mean, I haven't watched it for like over 10 years because of the ending, but I really loved that film right up to the ending. And the ending is so awful that I now cannot watch the film. It's awful because it's saccharine, it's false, it's just horrific. The film is actually really, it deals with lots of dark themes all the way through, but in quite a beautiful way. And then the ending shatters all of that kind of depth and just showers you in sugar and goo. And then, there's a dog bounding up and it's come to heaven and the dog goes to heaven. And it's all like the absolutely the worst kind of ending of it's kind of, I suppose it's like, I would call it like a Hollywood ending because it's just, it's over the top, like in the extreme. So that's probably my least, that I hate that. I hate it when an ending it changes the tone. It doesn't fit the tone of the rest of the story. As I was saying right at the beginning of this panel, there is a logic. I feel like there is a logic to a good ending that a bad ending will simply not sit well with the rest of the book. And if that's tonally, if it's based on character, and if the character has something completely out of character, something that shocks you as a viewer or a reader, then that will make a bad ending for me. Good endings. Good endings are harder in a way because I don't often analyze good endings. I suppose I kind of say, well, I really enjoyed that book, or I really, really enjoyed that film, and I kind of look at it as an entire creative piece. Generally, it's the endings that stick in your head. One thing that annoyed me about a series that I absolutely love is Susan Cooper's The Dark is Rising. The whole sequence, the five books. She's a genius. It's the most amazing, amazing series. But in the final pages, it's probably not a spoiler to say, because look, this has been out since the 70s. Almost all the characters, bar one, forget the entire adventure. And I feel, while there is a sort of, you know, that bittersweet thing that I was espousing earlier, I do feel that making the characters kind of totally forget what has happened sort of invalidates in a way their entire journey, because, you know, I think her logic was, well, they don't really want to live in a world without magic, without wonder. And yet I would argue that they were instrumental in, you know, in creating the ending of their story, or in creating the world that they inherit, you know, as young people who are growing up to be adults. So it's funny, because even in things that I hold very close to my heart, I can still, you know, can still find something to be critical of. And that's always stayed with me. I've never really, it's not like I haven't forgiven her for that.
That's it. Almost like cheapens the series. You're like, I love this so much. And then all of a sudden you're just like, aw, that's how we're going to end.
Well, it's also about, it probably says a lot about me, because I'm like a creature of wonder who would like skip through the lands of wonder if I could. So to be told that, oh no, all the magic is gone. You're alone in the wilderness of brutal reality probably says more about me than maybe her book.
What about you, Sue?
Well, one ending that I hate, my husband hate, we still have rants with each other about how awful it was Babylon 5. As Lucy said, it did not fit the tone of the rest of it. Sometimes we'll look at something we don't like, and he and I have this shorthand now and just say, fucking angels. And that's an ending that just does not work. I'm passionate about that series. Don't watch it. It ends badly. There's the middle of it. Watch like the second to the last year of the show, and don't watch the full end. One book that I do like, I like a lot of books for their endings. One I want to recommend is Children of Time by Adrian Tchaikovsky. And what I like about that is almost at the end, in the very last, pretty much the lead up to the very last scene, there's like one sentence that just elevates the entire book and moves everything in it to a higher philosophical plane. And I like that ending for that reason, was that it was just, you could see what the characters were doing, and they were motivated by a higher intent. And they just became very good people.
Tchaikovsky's great. I love that book. Sebastian, what about you?
Yeah, I usually try to avoid the sort of saying the, you know, the bad stuff, only because, you know, whatever I feel is bad, someone else probably loves it. I don't want to trash on someone's favorite books. But as a kid, I mentioned the end of the Chronicles of Narnia. And I'm going to bring it up not to say that it's necessarily terrible, because maybe some people love it. And I remember liking it as a kid, but because I think it can be, it's kind of instructive. The genius of the Narnia books by C.S. Lewis is that they're unbelievably Christian focused, but at no point, I'm not a Christian, at no point, and nor was I as a kid, at no point did I ever feel like I was being indoctrinated. There was nothing that felt polemical about it, about the series at all. It was about wonder and adventure and friendship and loyalty and duty and all of these wonderful things that apply to all of us. And somehow in the last battle, in the final book of that series, Lewis kind of turns it into a polemic. And he starts telling you, no, you know, this is what's going to happen. And he screws Susan over, which is really totally unfair.
Big time.
And you know, by going into this kind of like, well, because she became too much of an adult, and she, you know, she became this, and therefore she can't see this, so she can't come into heaven, basically, because that's what the metaphor is sort of about. And it was just so explicit. And so I think what's instructive about it, what I try to remind myself about that, is that when you're writing your ending, it can be quite tempting to go, hey, now do you see the lesson, kids? The lesson was, you should be like me, because I'm right and everyone you know is wrong, and here's the way we should all be. And a story that's well told will communicate, even when you're not aware of what you're trying to say, will communicate what it is you deep down want to say regardless. So you don't need to go and kind of pound it home, which is sort of what I felt like Lewis did with that. So for me, that was like, it's not saying that's necessarily abandoning. It's an ending that tells, that reminds me, you know, don't act that way. Kind of like George on Seinfeld, you know, who's the character that's usually the most embarrassing of the characters. And I find it useful to watch and go, I wonder if I'm kind of the George of my community, the George Costanza. Anyway, sorry, that's a reference that's probably too old for lots of viewers. As far as good endings, you know, I sort of think like the end of any Nancy Drew novel is pretty great because, and again, it's sort of instructive, because it makes you go, ah, oh, yeah, that was a, you know, and then go, and now I want to pick up the next, another one. Not, this wasn't complete, and therefore I'm being forced, I'm being tricked into picking up the next one. But that was really fun, and it feels nicely closed off, so now I'm ready to do it. There's a scene, Dean Wesley Smith sometimes talks about this with stories, which is that you want kind of a valedictory moment. It's the medals in Star Wars, in the first Star Wars movie, where they all get their medals, I think, except for Chewbacca for some reason. Or one of the endings, the 58 endings of Lord of the Rings, where, you know, the Aragorn sort of being crowned, and, you know, the hobbits are going to kneel. He's like, no, you kneel for no one, my friends. That kind of valedictory ending. That's a scene where it's pure story. It's not polemical, but it is reaffirming for you what you kind of felt this was about, right? All the way along. And so I think that, and sort of those Nancy Drew type endings or Hardy Boys, nobody reads any of this stuff anymore. I don't know why I'm bringing it up. Sorry. But like, that's something you can do as a writer when you're like, I feel like I want to pound the point home a little bit in some way. Instead of doing it through dialogue, instead of having a character say, well, you know, as you all know, what we needed to learn was we must all be better people, is having a scene that sort of creates that feeling. And then that can be a nice way to close off.
Brian?
Like Lucy, I probably should have been prepared with a least favorite. I wasn't. But I guess since, because I already said it, that that Leave the World Behind, that's also a book. I can't speak for that, though. I haven't read it. But yeah, the movie, just getting back to it, it brought a bunch of kind of sci-fi mystery to things. The overall premise is the world's kind of falling apart and these odd happenings are occurring. And I'll just give an example of one that, like, is why I wasn't a big fan of it, was in the movie, there's a large herd of deer, and they keep kind of coming up and approaching the humans in it, which isn't really realistic in terms of why a wild group of deer. And, you know, the only explanation the movie gave for it, which they gave it early, so I thought more was going to come later, but the only explanation they gave was with the world's kind of falling apart, and it's basically saying that their herding patterns are, or their migrating patterns are changing because of kind of these terrible happenings occurring in cities and whatnot. That still never explained why they're just coming up and dozens of them are surrounding people and staring at them and then just running off. So, that's, I guess, my one example of something I didn't really like. But in terms of some of my favorites, I'm very much a series reader. These might not be the most original, but my favorite book by far is Lord of Chaos, the sixth book in the Wheel of Time series. I thought it just did a brilliant job of, you had, you know, the first book, you have all the characters kind of together. They get split up, and they're never really, early on in the series, they all get split up, and this was kind of one of those moments where they sort of started coming together, and that you have all these different arcs. I don't want to spoil anything for anyone who hasn't read it, but you have like an animal companionship arc with one character. He's finally embracing that. You have this other army that's been forming that you've been very curious about, have learned very little about, and they all finally come to a head in this big battle scene, which also is mixed in with the MC going through some pretty bad happenings and kind of a penultimate moment for him of breaking out. And it was just a perfect transition of bringing all the stuff that I loved about the series finally together and transitioning it to the, I guess you could say, towards the final act. I don't want to say final act. There were still eight books after that, but, you know, it kind of set the pace to lead towards the final act. And a very similar trope. Another one of my favorites is the fourth Harry Potter book, Goblet of Fire. I mean, kind of this goes back to what I think I said earlier. I like books where the ending is almost screaming at me what's going to happen. And that's kind of what that fourth book did. You've always known in the other three books, you have this great threat that's kind of in the background, overhanging this overarching theme, overshadowing the main story, but it was never fully part of that main story. And it finally, so that you get the hints in this fourth book that it's a little more at the forefront, but just so many happenings. You have the whole tournament aspect to the story that keep you kind of drawn away from it. You almost forget about it. And then when it slaps you in the face at the end of it, you're just like, whoa. And it kind of sets that stage now for the final books that got a little more mature in theme. And it really just changed the course of the series from there.
Yeah.
I thought of a good one. I thought of a good ending. The film Don't Look Up, if you've seen it, a recent film. What a great ending. You're this is the thing about the asteroid hitting Earth, and you're kind of like pre-programmed to go, no, they'll avert the disaster. They will, of course they will. It's like, you know, that's the kind of film. And they don't. Everyone dies apart from the guys who get away in the rocket, and then their cryogenic experience, which is just follows through on some stuff that they'd set up at the beginning of the film. And I was like, do you know what? I really appreciate that. They were saying it the whole way through. They were like, you know, the world is going to be fucked if we don't do this thing. And you know what? The world was. And I really appreciated the honesty of that. That was great.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I would say my least favorite is probably a lot of people's least favorite. I mean, granted, I've gone back and watched it again, and I'm like, okay, I can kind of see why they did it. But you know, Game of Thrones, you know, you have a series that is based on books, and you don't have an ending with the books, and so you pretty much make up your own ending, and you're just kind of like, that's not really how I saw it, but okay. And I've gone through and rewatched it, you know, after everybody had their, watch this again. And I was just like, it's kind of like a comfort watch now, because I really enjoy the first, you know, 5-6 seasons. But that's probably one of my least favorites. But one of my more recent, I guess, favorites, I don't know if anybody's watched The Crown on Netflix. I mean, it's fiction, but it's also, you know, it's fact, because they do know the happenings on the outside of the family, just from media and so forth, but they don't really know the inner workings, the conversations and so forth. But it, like, every episode, my wife and I just binge it. Every episode just was like, we'll just do one more. It's 11 o'clock. You know, we need to go to sleep. We've got two kids. Then you're like, it's 12:30. And you're like, we gotta the first 5 minutes of the next one, I promise. Well, it just constantly gets you back in there to do it. And I love series like that. I don't love missing sleep, but I do enjoy getting into a series where I just go, okay, we got to know what the next 5 to 10 minutes looks like, because this ends on a cliffhanger and clearly it's going to be answered, right? And then you're 30 minutes in and it still hasn't been answered, but you know it's coming. It's just fantastic. And I did want to give a shout to Mark. He wasn't able to make it to the panel, but he was able to make it into the chat. So he spoiled our ending for our panel, though. So saying that everybody's gonna be removing their masks. So if anybody's a different panelist, go ahead and remove your mask. Just want to kind of wrap everything up now. So I want everybody to take kind of a moment. Tell everybody where they can find you on social media, websites, et cetera. Maybe your most recent book that you've got out, book that's upcoming, and I guess where people can find it. So Lucy, we'll start with you.
You can find me at Sylvan Historian, Sylvan with an I, across pretty much every media, social media channel, apart from, well, I am on TikTok, but come on, TikTok is a hellhole, hellscape of evil, so I'm not usually there. If you want to keep up with me on social media, it's probably best to follow me on Instagram, though I am on Twitter. I refuse to call it anything else, and Blue Sky as well. My next book, as I showed you, this is actually the UK proof cover. The real cover is a lovely red and gold It's a very, very cool cover. I've got very lucky with my covers. Song of the Huntress. Yeah, it's another historical fantasy. It is set in the same world as Sister Song, just 170 years further on in time. It's got a few Easter eggs for Sister Song fans. So, you know, they'll definitely hopefully pick those up. It's, as I said, a retelling of the Wild Hunt myth. Basically, Wild Hunt myth appears in various different guises across various different countries. I've set mine in about 710 AD in the Saxon Kingdom of Wessex. So if you fancy any fancy history with your fantasy or fantasy with your history, then hopefully you'll give it a read. It's out in the US with Orbit and in the UK with Pan Macmillan.
Fantastic. Sue?
Well, the book that I have out right now is Dual Memory, and the hardcover is out. There'll be a trade paperback that comes out in April, if you want to save a little money. The third book in the Semiosis trilogy is Usurpation, and that will come out in October. I'm actually going through the copy edits right now, so it's on track. And if you want to learn more about me, I have a website. And it's Sue Burke, one word, .site. So SueBurke.site, and you can find out everything there is to know.
Fantastic. Sebastian?
Yeah. So the current book is Crucible of Chaos. If you like the idea of a swashbuckling Hercule Poirot meets the X-Files, that's kind of what it's about, set in the Great Coats world. On a fictional monastery separated on an island separated by a causeway from the mainland that's kind of rooted in Mont Saint-Michel for anyone who's ever been there. Yep. Full of, you know, strange magic and demons and stuff, but mostly just a very pompous investigator and his extremely loyal mule. And then coming out in the end of March in the UK and elsewhere and early April in North America is Play of Shadows, which is kind of like Shakespeare in Love, but with way more sword fights. And if you haven't seen Shakespeare in Love, then you should watch it because it's wonderful.
Such a great film.
Yeah, but it's also set in the Great Coats world. All these books in the Court of Shadows series are, they're all part of the series, but they're also kind of, they work as standalones. So you don't have to feel like you're suddenly got to invest and you're going to finish the book and then feel like, oh, you won't know the answer to anything until a year later when something else comes out. It's each one sort of works as a standalone. They link together. There's also Fate of the Argosy, which is the third of the Argosy series, but since nobody's read any of those books, it probably doesn't matter.
Brian?
If for following purposes or whatever, I'm probably most active on Instagram. It's brian.wilson.author. I'm also on Twitter, B. Wilson author. My first book that's currently out right now, The Forsaken Planet. It's purely coincidence. My daughter's painted my nails to match the font cover here. This is out. This is available. And I went over in the beginning what it's mostly about in my second novel. And we have it on my phone right now, but right there. That is coming out April 16th. It's the second of the Power of the Stars series installment. And whereas my first was more battle school, kind of trope-ish, you know, it still has the fun space opera vibe, but this is more a Mission Impossible, Indiana Jones adventure kind of take on my characters. And besides that, I'm hoping to also get a novella out. That would kind of be book 2.5 of the series. I'm hoping to have it out this year. I started it, haven't gotten very far, and it'll work as a standalone, but it'd be best be read between the second and third installments of the series.
Okay. And for Mark Lawrence, you can find him on Twitter at Mark_Lawrence. His library trilogy, book one, the book that went and burned, came out last year. It's actually up for an FanFi Addict Award for this year for best traditionally published novel from last year. Book two will be out this summer, which I know a lot of people are looking forward to. And just hate that Mark couldn't make it, but completely understand. Life happens. But we wish him the best. And thank my panelists for being here. Thank you all for taking the time to come hang out and talk about great endings and bad endings and endings that probably could have changed a little bit. And want to thank everybody that tuned in and that will be tuning in the future. Coming up next is the role of place and atmosphere in horror. It's coming up in about 40 minutes, so stay tuned. If you're into horror novels and horror authors, that one should be a pretty good time. So, but again, thank you all so much, and enjoy the rest of TBRCon.